It was raining heavily at Swope Park yesterday, so a bunch of people on a mission were gathered under the pavilion until the rain passed.
It could be much worse.
It could be wet from sweating or wet from rain.
Right.
It's kind of like a football game, just keep on going. We put all this force effort into it, but we enjoy doing it. That's why we're here.
These are the intrepid members of Kansas City's Ethnic Enrichment Commission, gathered at the park to set up the city's annual celebration of international food and culture. If you've been to the event, you know it's popular. Each booth represents a different culture within Kansas City. Grown-ups line up for the albondigas, samosas, and crepes. Kids line up to get their passports stamped. Everybody's happy, right? But the Ethnic Enrichment Festival's been going on for 36 years, and a lot has changed in how we think about ethnicity and American culture. Is Kansas City keeping pace? Is there something almost refreshing in this day and age in the simplicity of eating, drinking, and dancing together? I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's what we're discussing today on Central Standard. I'd like to start by chatting with Marty Wilson. She works for the Indonesia booth at the Ethnic Enrichment Festival. Hi.
Hi, good morning, Gina.
How long have you been doing this?
The Indonesian group has been doing this since 2003. And actually, I started going to the festival since before I got married, because my husband, then was my boyfriend, took me there when I was visiting him in Kansas City. I went to school in Minnesota. So it has been a while, long time. And Kansas City Ethnic Festival is always a place to go for me when I was still in college.
What inspires you to want to share Indonesian culture with Kansas City in this way?
Well, Indonesia, not many people in this Midwest, in this metro or Midwest know where Indonesia is. When we talk about Indonesia, they said, oh, is it part of Bali? And actually, Bali is one of 18,000 islands in Indonesia. So Bali, the island of Bali is just, if you go to the map, it's just almost a spot compared to the whole country. So I try to promote Indonesia, the culture, the food, and the location, and everything, the people. We are very friendly people. And even though Indonesia is the fourth largest country in the world, not many people know where Indonesia is.
So, yeah, it sounds like maybe just that people generally don't seem very familiar on a pretty basic level with where you come from and the culture that you want to take this opportunity.
Yes, yes. And with this ethnic festival is the place and the chance for us to promote Indonesia, to promote the country, the culture.
What does it mean to promote it?
Well, we are trying to let people know, because Indonesia is not just 180,000 islands and located between Australia and the continent of Asia. It has many ethnic groups. So when you say Indonesia, which part of Indonesia, and then it's just very diverse, very diverse. Over 600 ethnic groups, and then over 300 languages spoken. So when I say I'm speaking Indonesian, Indonesian is not my original or is not my mother tongue language. So it's actually it's going to be forever if I speak about Indonesia.
That's okay. You know, I think how do you express a culture that has so much diversity within it in these brief encounters that you get with one visitor at a time at the Ethnic Enrichment Festival? Do you get the opportunity to share very much, or do you think of what you do as just giving an introduction?
Yes, it's more like introduction. We have books about Indonesia. We have a map to show people where Indonesia is located, and then the travel, how to get there from Kansas City. Because Kansas City is in the middle of the continent, and Indonesia is not easy to get to. But actually, it's getting easier now with the United, that we can go there in 23 hours compared to 36 hours or 42 hours travel time.
23 hours is a pretty long trip, but I'm glad it's getting shorter for you. Does Kansas City have a large Indonesian community?
We have over... 150, so between 150 and 200, not many.
Tell me about some memorable moments you've had working the Indonesia booth at the Ethnic Enrichment Festival over the years. I mean, have you had moments where you felt like you made a real connection with someone, either someone working at the booth or a visitor?
Oh, yeah. It's surprising that there are many people from Kansas City have been to Indonesia and work in Indonesia or visited Indonesia. So, well, Indonesia meaning maybe for them Bali, the island of Bali. But we are very excited and get connected. And then I was invited to, a couple of times, my dance group were invited to perform at the wedding.
Oh, cool. So you made a connection that way too.
Oh yes. And then actually from the wedding magazine, Kansas City Wedding Magazine, called me, asked me if it's okay to put our group in the magazine. I said, yeah.
How has the festival changed in the years that you've been a part of it? Are there communities in Kansas City that are participating now that weren't a part of it in the early days, even when you just went for fun?
Yes. Actually, we just had our Indonesian Independence picnic. Our Independence Day was on the 17th. Oh, it's always on the 17th of August. And then we just celebrated our 70th birthday, Indonesia. And we had a picnic. And then there are some people that I just met, and they have been here forever. And then I invited them to the ethnic festival, and then they said they have been to the ethnic festival. They visited my booth, but they didn't see me. But there are some people who Indonesian who I have not met before, and then I would like to see them hopefully at a picnic. And then also there are some exchange students from Indonesia who came here to study for a year, and then they already contacted me. They wanted to come. And
so do you feel like this is a way for the people in Kansas City who have connections to a place, to a shared place or a shared culture, to get to know each other and connect?
Oh, yes. Yes, for sure, yes. And because we are all excited about and proud of our culture, and this is the place where you not just to get the ethnic food from your country and also from other countries.
Let's hear from a couple of other guests. I'd like to introduce Jose Faust. He's a writer in town and the co-founder of the Latino Writers Collective. Jose, you go to the festival most years, right?
I'd say I've gone probably about 19 times.
Wow, 19. Yeah. Pretty good. What do you get from the experience?
Food. I'm sorry about that. The food is amazing. It's a great introduction to the culture. But then I think also just the conviviality that takes place. People are so open about sharing what they have, where they come from. And I think that kind of just breeds this really nice sense of place, belonging. You know, you create community in this little kind of bucolic setting, and you walk around, and there's that circle. And then you have the entertainment under the pavilion. A lot of things happening. And I think that's just awesome. It's just a really nice feeling.
Do you think that there is a way to create more of that kind of a feeling outside of a festival environment? I mean, it seems like if people are craving that kind of atmosphere, why can't we just make that happen generally?
I think it's happening. There's some things that happen. There's some celebrations that take place. I think of one in particular, like the Bud Park over in the Northeast. The consulate has this thing called the Bike Rodeo, where they bring in, you know, they give bikes to kids. I think they've done it 3 years. And, you know, when you see that happening in that park, all these kids come out and it brings a whole bunch of different communities together. So it's not just like a Latino festival or anything like that. It's really a community festival. So there's things like that. You also, when she mentioned about the picnics, I think we just had one not too long ago, the Puerto Rican Boricua picnic, and they have like two a year. Haitian Independence, they have a festival, and it's open to the community. They have a picnics, Independence picnic, usually at Loose Park. So there's a lot of these things that happen, and I think it's just a matter of people being open and going to them. embracing them and just being curious because they're always welcoming.
There's some irony, I think, in what you described about a sense of place at this festival where there's a booth for as many different cultures as people can find representatives of in Kansas City. So you have this sort of, international forum that creates its own sense of place. Do you see what I mean?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, it's funny because when you look at what is being shared there, you see all the commonalities. I mean, food is a big thing that draws people to it. The traditional crafts, the costumes, the music itself. And you begin to realize, you know, these are the things we celebrate culturally. I mean, we don't live in little vacuums where food is just us. It's really all these regional flavors and spices and all these different things. Music, you know, you have scales, tonal things that you play. They're basically universal. And you create rhythms, and there's all this syncopation that takes place, but it creates something that invites people in. And I think that's, you know, it's shared. I mean, we can't look and say, well, I can't relate to those people. I don't eat. I don't relate to those people. I don't like music. I don't relate to those people. I don't wear clothes. Well, no, you do. You know what I mean? It's like it's all covered.
Ethnicity in America is a complex thing. I mean, do you think there's a danger of oversimplifying? Like, most people don't fit neatly into one group that could have its own booth. Some do, but a lot of people don't. And even those who do are probably living a day-to-day reality that's pretty far removed from traditional songs and dances like the ones that get celebrated. So I guess I'm wondering, is there a danger in that simplification? And how do we make the leap from a performance of culture to everyday understanding? Mm-hmm.
There is a danger. I think about this. I wrote something about it years ago, and the experience being, I remember somebody saying, oh, yeah, I love Mexican culture. I go and eat at this restaurant, and oh, it's just like, you know, it must be what Mexico's like. But you didn't realize there's so many regional flavors that are distinct from one town to another, from one region to another, separated sometimes by a river, a mountain range, or something. So to simplify it and think that you've experienced something just by this offering kind of narrows the experience. It really makes it think like, oh, I've done my part. But really, you have to go broader than that. You have to go to, you know, if you're ever fortunate enough to be invited to a wedding, to be invited to a baptism, to be invited to a coming-of-age ceremony, or even a celebration of a business deal or some nice community event, that's where you start to really expand it. And also that's where you see some of the things that don't jive, you know, like the kids that maybe their first generation and they kind of start to run away from their parents' culture. Eventually they come back to it, maybe their second or third or fourth generation. But you see those tensions. You see kids trying to fit into a culture that is not as open. It pretty much is very much dictated by what you hear in the radio, what you see on TV.
Anthony Hsu is also here with us, and I'd like to get his take on this. He's with us from UMKC's English department, where he focuses on ethnic and cultural studies. Hi, Anthony.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. How about you?
Good.
I enjoy this event, the Ethnic Enrichment Festival. I go most years, and this might also be a good time to acknowledge that KCUR is a sponsor of the event. But I need to acknowledge that the phrase ethnic enrichment, while very earnest and sweet, makes me feel a little self-conscious. Can you help me figure out why that might be?
Enrichment's a really interesting word, right? It has two meanings. One would be that it's related to knowledge, right? In other words, one gains knowledge of a particular subject matter. It also involves or is related to money, right? In other words, one it becomes richer, literally profits by it. I think one thing that makes me uneasy, and perhaps this is what's kind of fueling your uneasiness too, is that there is always a sense of currency going around in terms of identity here and, you know, what gets accepted. I mean, you know, just listening to the story about the Indonesian booth, it seems like it's almost an impossible task, right? In other words, you have to you have one booth that represents hundreds, if not thousands, of different groups, dialects, traditions. And so things get consolidated, and they get consolidated, perhaps homogenized, in order to present something to the public, right? And so there, you know, that homogenization is really interesting, and it's a process where decisions are made, and those kinds of decisions are influenced by any number of factors.
Is the Ethnic Enrichment Festival representative of a type of event or a particular approach to cultural understanding in America?
I think so. I mean, I think if you look in the 19th and 20th century when you're dealing especially with immigrants, I mean, you'll see a lot of literature on this, scholarly literature on especially European immigrants. There were ethnic pageants for both Western and Eastern European groups. But, you know, there have always been consulate events as well where they invite Americans to come experience the culture of a particular country. And that's maybe one thing that we can talk about, too. There seems to be a slippage between this notion of the festival as a gathering of nations, but then we talk about them as cultures. But that appellation or that name, cultures, is very complex, whereas...
Explain the distinction a little more.
Well, I mean, you know, a nation is a geopolitical entity, right? In other words, it's a consolidation of peoples, and a culture is, I mean, we have so many different definitions of it. It can range anywhere from social practices to even assumptions about how certain people behave, right? We have things like cultural competency programs that assume certain kinds of etiquette that are appropriate for different countries or different societies, right? So that slippage is really interesting.
How long have you lived in Kansas City?
Since 2007.
And what other kinds of opportunities do you notice in Kansas City for people of different cultures to get together and learn about one another? Does it happen organically?
I would think, you know, just kind of agreeing with Jose, it seems to happen, it's an event-based kind of interaction, sense of interaction that we have in town. I've been most involved mainly because my partner belongs to the Filipino Association of Greater Kansas City with their events and great turnout over at their facility in Overland Park. I don't get the sense that this happens organically. In other words, that there is a sense of staging going on with these interactions. And I think historically that's something that we've seen. You know, at the same time, you know, there are other I'm sure that, you know, we can imagine other opportunities as well.
Jose, what do you think about this?
You know, it's funny. I was thinking about the staged event is the thing we're more comfortable with because kind of has this idea that A will go to B to C and D, and then it'll wrap up and we'll be fine and we'll go back. But I think about things like, so you have the Samuel Rogers Center, the clinic over there. And I think the last time I heard, they have up to 37 different languages represented there to treat the people that come into the center for treatment, clinical treatment. And when you think about that, you have to realize their language is not... an easy thing to give up. People struggle with saying, okay, you will narrate and speak only, and your experiences will come only through the through the English tongue. But you lose an incredible richness and also comfort that the language provides. So I'm a person that I really believe that when we get comfortable with the way other people are and speak and accept that that's not necessarily meaning I'm going to stay outside always, then I think we can create something better.
So the event-based kind of interaction is a good starting point for being comfortable.
Yes, for being comfortable and introduced to something you don't think about. I can remember my very first experience going to the Ethnic Festival, and I think it was like 83. And it was only something that I saw in the paper, and they said all these cultures are going to be represented. And I'm going, even... me, as curious as I am, was not aware that there would be that many, and I was shocked when we got there and there were so many booths. So it was a nice intro, but it also should spark curiosity. How does this community integrate? What are the institutions that they bring and they find comfort in? Where are the places that they navigate? And are they open to me? And I think that's the next step. Because, you know, we expect the cultures that exist right now. You want to shop, you go to this grocery store. You want this, you go over here. You need whatever things you need, you have to come to these set places. And it's only over time that all of a sudden somebody says, you know what, we've got to provide ethnic products. And one of the things you have to accept sometimes in a community is that there may be food deserts and stuff like that, but don't discount that there are neighborhood grocers there that supply the needs of those ethnic communities. Shop at them. You know, it doesn't have to be a Walmart. It doesn't have to be a Price Chopper to validate that community. Strengthen the ones that exist there, and you create better opportunities.
Anthony, what are you hearing in this?
You know, what I'm interested in is that, and I was thinking about this as Jose and our other guests were talking is that, you know, there's been a long tradition of mutual aid societies or family societies, especially, you know, I'm Chinese American, so that's my research is about those family or benevolent societies.
Explain what those are.
Well, I mean, these are community organizations. I think it's exactly what Jose is talking about. You know, these are organizations that will cater towards especially first generation immigrants, but, you know, further on down the line, multi-generational families that provide support, translation services, healthcare, general services so that people can transition to American society. And so I'm not using the word integrate, right? I mean, you know, in other words, that there is a sense that that these people can function in America and there's no necessarily preset script to their identities at all. But these are kind of internal organizations that you'll see kind of, they'll manifest themselves in public in terms of events and other things. But at the same time, there's a whole, I wouldn't say it's an invisible world, but it's a world that I think mainstream society doesn't necessarily pay attention to or, you know, have access to for whatever reason.
How would you characterize cultural and race relations in Kansas City in general? I'm wondering if that kind of sets the backdrop for events like these.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm the authority on that. You know, I've only been here since 2007. You know, I come from the South, but I come from a diverse city in the South, New Orleans. You know, what I would say is that, you know, the style of interaction here is a little bit different than what I'm used to. I'm used to a little bit more combative style of relation. We're very polite in Kansas City, it seems. So, you know, I've been working at that, but against it as well. You know, I also get the sense, too, that you know, in some ways, the conversations that are being had now on the other side of the state aren't necessarily ones that would be invited here, right? In other words,
you mean near Ferguson?
Near Ferguson, sure. You know, anything, for example, like the Black Lives Matter conversations, these aren't necessarily conversations that would be either, excuse me, either welcome or encouraged as much as they could be. And so, you know, maybe that etiquette here is something that we should talk about.
Central Standard's off to a break. Call us up to join the conversation when we return. Are there enough opportunities in Kansas City for different cultures and ethnicities to intersect? How do you create those opportunities without being super awkward and self-conscious about it? 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Gina Kaufman. We're wondering, what are the opportunities for people of different backgrounds to cross paths and share experiences, to celebrate and learn about one another's stories, or even just to try each other's foods? 816-235-2888 is the number to call to join the conversation. My guests are the Ethnic Enrichment Festival's Marty Wilson, who's been working the Indonesia booth at the festival since 2003, Jose Faust of the Latino Writers Collective, and Anthony Hsu from UMKC's English Department. Marty, do you feel you have opportunities throughout the year to connect with your Indonesian heritage and share it with other people in Kansas City?
Oh, yes. And then the Ethnic Enrichment Commission is a good place to, the best place, actually, to do this. And then beside the ethnic festival, we also do diplomatic ball and other events throughout the city. So it gives me a chance not just to do the ethnic festival, we also do other events. Even there are a couple other ethnic festivals around Kansas City that we also involve. And then,
but it's so mostly event. It's mostly event based for you too, like what we were saying.
Yes.
Do you find that there are communities that just gather kind of organically, or are the events really an important part of having people feel connected?
Yeah, I think the events is very good for us to promote the diversity in Kansas City also, and besides trying to get people, like you said, to bring people together.
Well, thanks so much, Marty Wilson. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, thank you so much. Please don't forget to visit us. We have a event. We have a 3-day festival, and the performances are different every 3 minutes from 60 different countries. So, Indonesia will be performing at 11:30 on Sunday.
Very cool. Well, good luck, and I hope the rain clears up for you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Bye. You know, listening to Marty, and it seems like a big part of what people get out of this is not just a chance to connect, but also a chance to celebrate. And I think of that as really distinct from dissecting and debating issues, which I have to admit is kind of refreshing, especially in contrast to like a call-out culture where dialogue tends to focus on who did what wrong. Anthony, what do you think about celebration as sort of a safe space?
I think that's a perfect phrase to use, right? I mean, it's safe in the sense that it, and I don't mean to sound cynical here, right? It's safe in the sense that you're not going to be confronted. You're not going to be necessarily engaging in a kind of dialogue that will, you know, to be frank, that will challenge you. I think it depends a lot on the person and their curiosity. But at the same time, this is, you know, these kinds of events, just in general, don't necessarily speak to maybe kind of those tensions in society that are there. They tend to diffuse them. And, you know, perhaps that's something that people actively seek out. But at the same time, it's not the only kind of outcome that we should or could expect.
I totally agree with that. I think it is, it's a safe space. It's a celebratory space. But, you know, there are, as the society gets more and more complex, and I'm meaning here in Kansas City, I can recall one statistic years ago where I looked at the census demographics for the area and realized that, like Johnson County and some of the outlying suburbs had like 1% ethnic composition. And now you can look at some of those same areas and you're looking at 10, 12%. Grandview, I think, is like almost 30 or more. That's a radical shift. And with a radical shift like that comes things, the tensions. The celebration is one part, but there are underlying tensions because people want to homogenize what the American experience is, when in fact we bring so many different stories to it. There's so many different places where we come from. And it's a shared history. And I think if we don't hear those stories, not necessarily from, you know, somebody that came maybe 20, 30, 40, 50, 100 years ago, but that just recently arrived from any different place in the world, you'll find so much similarity. And then there's also the indigenous stories, the people that were here before that have the stories to tell. And those are issues you have to confront. You have to deal with them. And I think the celebration is a nice intro to realize that you're not everybody looks exactly like you, and that there is a broader community that's taking place here, that's growing here.
This reminds me a little bit of an argument that took place in a college class I took. The professor asked if tolerance, we were talking about tolerance, and if that was a lofty enough goal. And one student very sweetly said that it would be better if we would not just tolerate difference, but celebrate difference. And someone else got really kind of irate about that and said, you know, I have the right to not celebrate everything, and that if I celebrate everything, that's actually kind of disingenuous. And I wonder if that argument is kind of part of what we're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, tolerance is a really curious word. I mean, you tolerate a lot of different conditions and situations, but, you know, in terms of dealing with people, it seems to be a strange usage, right? And celebration is a really interesting word, too. I don't think we necessarily have a language for yet for, you know, perhaps what we're trying to think about in terms of kind of future interactions. This is, you know, in some ways you can look at what we have, if they're safe spaces, as ways to, they're modes of social maintenance, right? I don't want to use too much academic language, but they're authorized and you know, perhaps at certain times, we've already talked about the homogenization that happens. So, you know, if we live in a segregated society, which we do, but it's getting a little bit more integrated as time goes on, and our social worlds are changing, both spatially and in terms of our relationships, I think we'll have to kind of think about new goals and set new goals. You know, tolerance is probably kind of base level. It's something that that one would do sometimes with uncomfortable conditions, right? Mm-hmm. But transforming them, I think, is something that, you know, is a really interesting conversation to have.
Transformation, I think that's the key in what you just said. One of the things that I can recall, we talk about the celebratory part, but, you know, you go down to the River Market on the weekends, and you'll hear different voices, you'll hear different languages, you'll see different clothing, different approaches. And that's a space that you go to. You're not looking for a celebration. You're looking to buy. You're looking for commerce.
But it does feel good to be in it.
Oh, it feels great. And to hear the different languages. I remember the first time I went to the market, it used to be a lot of Italians. And I would hear the Italian men and women speaking to each other. And I marveled at how beautiful that was, because insulated as we were, I lived in the suburbs at first, after we left the West Side. And you didn't hear languages. You didn't hear other languages. And so I celebrate that. And one of the things we do at the Latino Writers Collective, one of the things we're doing this year is we're celebrating that language. We have people that come to our meetings who support the group, but then sit there and go, you know, I don't write in English, my first language in Spanish. So we said, you know what, we're going to create an anthology that celebrates that language. And if somebody's upset, fine. But you know what, there's enough people here that would love to hear the Spanish spoken, who don't necessarily want to turn away from it just to be a part of something bigger. They feel that experience contributes to the whole fabric, and we want to celebrate that. And that's transformative, to get people to accept that to do something is not to be against something else.
Yeah, the sort of coexistence, just simple coexistence. Mm-hmm. What about stereotypes? How do we honor traditions that are often associated with the past, not just with another place, but with another time as well, without reinforcing stereotypes or giving people the idea that these cultures exist only in the past?
You know, I had a great experience. A friend of mine named Matt de Hamers is a sculptor, and he wanted to, he's Belgian origin, and he wanted to talk about his experience. And he was making a sculpture, and he asked me if I would contribute a poem to it. And we had a conversation. We talked for about 2 hours. And it was an interview, and on that I based this 12-part poem. But the one thing that I got so distinctly from it is that his narrative, his story, his family stories was so similar to so many other stories I've heard, whether you're coming from Africa, South America, anywhere. And that commonality, I think that's the one thing that we've lost. We do not realize or accept that we all have basically a lot of the same stories. Again, I'm not talking about the indigenous ones that are here. That's a different problem we have to deal with.
But the immigrant story.
The immigrant story is you cannot discount it. I think every family that is not native to the Americas has that story.
Yeah, I think you have to allow also for some, I wouldn't necessarily call it descent, but for a wide range of stories as well. You know, just kind of a personal example, you know, my father's from Hong Kong. He grew up under British rule. He has a much different experience of being Chinese than someone from the mainland or from someone from Taiwan. So, you know, in some ways, their relationship to, say, British imperialism certainly informs my interest in what I do research on. But it's much different than someone that's Taiwanese-American who's dealing with not being recognized as a legitimate culture or country, right?
So, yeah, I mean, so much of experience, no matter where you live in the world at this point, has to do with cultures, I mean, I hate to say colliding, because it's not always as catastrophic as that, but people don't live in a vacuum. It's a global world, and people are sort of influenced by so many different kinds of encounters. And so this idea that, yeah, how do we preserve and connect with a culture and also have a really authentic individual experience?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I do, you know, I teach American literature, and I'm really interested in the ethnic experience in the early 20th century. So I make sure to teach, for every, say, example, like Mary Antin's The Promised Land, which I think some would call an assimilationist narrative, I'll teach a short story by Anzia Yezierska, which is highly critical of integration strategies in America. You know, this is not necessarily to valorize a certain kind of uncritical dissent. I think what happens, especially with the exercise that I do, is that you can see that there are a lot of different ways to imagine what America is and what it can be. And unfortunately, what we tend to do here is, and you know, just in general, I won't speak about any kind of particular classes or interactions that we've had, but people will toe a party line when it comes to immigrant literature, for example. They will say, well, immigrants always come here for a better life, perhaps. You know, this is a very complex situation. But, you know, from that kind of easy generality or generalization, you're going to find people's ideas about relationships being perhaps easily generalized when perhaps they need to be more complicated.
Central Standard has to take one more break this morning. We'll resume this conversation about ethnicity in Kansas City when we return. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. This is Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. Let's get back to the quest for ethnic enrichment in Kansas City. What does that phrase mean to you, and what are its pitfalls? You still have just a little time to join the conversation at 816-235-2888. You'll be speaking with Jose Faust and Anthony Hsu. Now, we heard earlier in the show a personal story about one person's connection to Indonesian culture and how she connects with other people about that in Kansas City. But Jose and Anthony, we haven't really done that with you. I'm curious about your cultural ties and whether there are ways that you do and don't like to see those celebrated. I'll start with you, Jose.
I embrace them a lot. I can recall my experience as an immigrant. I remember my mother had a very strong, I tell this story, my mother had a very strong accent. And she saw that, how that affected her in her communications with people. She was an artist. But she saw that the minute that people heard that accent, there was a wall that came up. So when we got here to this country, I was about 9 years old, and she made a judgment. She made a decision. She said, we will not speak Spanish in the house. We will stop. You guys will learn English. And you know, it forced me. I mean, I love the English language, and I write in it and think of it and dream in it. But I think I lost a lot when my mother made that decision. And I recall I was 18 years old, and I was working on the West Side, and I walked into a store with a friend of mine. I was delivering Mexican products. And the guy asked me a question, and without me thinking, he asked it in Spanish, and I responded in Spanish, and we started conversing. And as I left the store, I remember my friend kind of hit me on the shoulder going, man, I didn't know you spoke Spanish. And I said, I think I do, yeah. And he says, well, you were just talking to him. I was not even aware. It was a trigger that just happened. And from that moment on, I began to embrace that. I met Chilenos. I've met Argentinians. I met a lot of people. And I seek it out. I love to hear the language. I read it. I went back and started. In college, you're not taught. You know, your writers are, I was an English major, and of course it was English writers. I went and looked for my own writers. I went and found Colombian writers, Argentinian writers. I went and found other writers from other worlds. And I think that's something that I was driven to because I realized at one point I had lost that.
What about you, Anthony? Do you have your own story and experience that informs how you do and don't like to see these things kind of playing out?
Yeah, I like to joke that I was raised in the suburbs, so I was kind of raised in captivity. You know, but at the same time, I grew up in a metropolitan area and moved around, eventually went to school in the Midwest and in New England as well. I was in a similar situation as Jose. You know, we only spoke English at home. I think it's ironic that, you know, I chose English as a profession and chose to get my degrees in it, mainly because you know, in some senses, it's one of the more exclusive disciplines. But at the same time, it's since the 60s, since the late 60s, it's been shifting and changing. And so for me, there's a lot of potential there to kind of engage the kinds of issues that I'm interested in, to meet the kinds of people that like to think about these issues across the board, but, you know, also to be involved with other Asian Americans in terms of thinking about, you know, the kinds of issues that affect primarily us, but can be translated out to maybe kind of a larger cross-ethnic or multi-ethnic context.
You know? What about this question of ways that you do and don't like to see your culture celebrated? I mean, is there anything that is especially cringeworthy for you?
Oh, there's tons that's cringeworthy. I think, you know, one thing, maybe the main thing or the main interface or way that Americans are, you know, kind of engage it is just costumes, right? I mean, you know, for me, you know, there's a long history of not only blackface in America, but yellowface as well that, you know, seemed to be dying down, then it kind of reemerged.
Yellowface being sort of appropriating Asian culture, trying to dress up.
Yeah, and it can be dressed. It can actually be, you know, you look at certain ethnic parties or racial parties around the U.S. college students have, right, where they'll tape up eyelids or, you know, et cetera.
Wait, that's real?
That's real, sure. You know, at the same time, something like in the 90s, sumo suits came out when people started wrestling in sumo suits, and they used to come with the hair and the top knot on top, right? So kimonos, you know, in some ways, you know, what activists, Asian American activists especially, are concerned with is that, you know, Asian Americans are seen as perpetually foreign and something that is not necessarily related to an American experience. And so it's something that they're worried about continually.
Jose, your cringeworthy experiences of people meaning to celebrate you and where you come from?
Cinco de Mayo drives me up a wall. It's like, I remember one experience. This, it says a lot about the culture, too, but this little girl coming to, I was working at Maddie Rhodes as a youth advocate, and she was really distraught one day, and she was upset, and I said, what's the matter? She says, well, you know, I don't know why African Americans have Martin Luther King Day, and we can't celebrate Cinco de Mayo, our Independence Day. And I was like, oh, my God, it's like, yeah, it totally bugged the snot out of me. But, you know, how could you, but it was a teaching moment as well.
Do you respond in situations like that?
Well, I definitely took her aside, and I said, you know, I understand your anger, but, you know, let's look at this. Cinco de Mayo is not Independence Day, you know. It's coming up. It's September. There's a lot of things. But also then we had a discussion about celebrating the life of Martin Luther King as a champion of civil rights, and addressing the issue that there are some things wrong in the society. Everything is not a party. And in fact, Cinco de Mayo is really more like what they've done with St. Patrick's Day. It's just another opportunity, commercial thing that, you know, we go out and celebrate and have. But it masks some really important issues that need to be addressed. And that's the absence of teaching our histories.
Yeah, I would agree. You know, I mean, there's if we're still talking about cringeworthy events, right, but also ways to kind of think otherwise or new ways about them. You know, I think it would be that you'd have to be able to think about identity and histories is more inclusive, right? I mean, in other words, that the American story, the American narrative is something much more complex than we're allowing it to be. And, you know, who allows what to be said about these kinds of situations, these kinds of groups is really intriguing, right? And it's something that is perhaps the central problem that we're having, the kind of discourse that we have about this. But, you know, one thing I'll say too is that, you know, I go shopping, I go to Asian markets, I see especially the young white kids come in that are fascinated with manga and anime, and then usually they only buy Asian snacks. They're not really necessarily familiar with the food ways, but, you know, in some way there's a kind of curiosity there and an engagement, but that engagement, whether it's sustained or not, is something that isn't necessarily incumbent upon them to pursue, right? And so it's not that challenging of an engagement, I should say.
Let's hear from Dorinda. Hi, Dorinda. Dorinda's calling us from Raytown.
I am. Good morning. Aloha to all of you.
Thanks for joining us.
My comment is from growing up in Hawaii of a Hawaiian mother whose first language is Hawaiian, which is not so true anymore with the loss of our language, is that if you lose your language, you lose your culture. And this is what was happening in the islands. And when my mother went to school, she was punished if she spoke Hawaiian. So when she married my father from Independence, Missouri, she said, my children are going to be very good American citizens. We will not speak Hawaiian in our home. And I want you to speak very, very good English. And so I was born and raised during the time where we did not speak our language. And so the only time I could hear it was when my mother's sisters and brothers would get together, and I loved it. So what happened in 76 has started to be the rejuvenation of our language, and we started some Hawaiian immersion schools. We couldn't find anybody to teach it because those of my mother's age were gone, and so we had to relearn our language, and I was so jealous in going to visit a second grade school, and the teacher stood outside the classroom and chanted to her students in Hawaiian that she was there to put the spirit of Hawaiian language and learning into them, and would they please enter and come and learn. And let me tell you, nobody fell asleep in that class or was elbowing their neighbor because they were already in that, yes, give me my language back. So here are second graders doing math in Hawaiian, and I was so jealous. So aww. Now you have my generation who is so hungry to go back, and we want to learn to chant in our language. And then my mother was a hula teacher, so my hulas were all done in English. I danced to Andy Williams, to Bootsy Lau, Little Grass Shack. And now I want to dance to the drums and to the beat of the island. So you lose your language, you lose your culture. And this, you know, it's happened to the American Indians. It almost happened to the Hawaiians.
Thank you so much for that call, Dorinda. Let's talk to Mike in Lawrence. Hi, Mike.
I want to thank you for this conversation this morning. 10 years ago, I was a participant in the protest against the Chiefs and the Redskins with Amanda Blackhorse, with Ryan Redcorn and Denny Gayton and Vernon Bellacourt, and they stuck us right out there on I-70.
Against the names of those sports teams?
Yeah, we protested that. The thing, the girl that's leading, the woman that's leading the lawsuit against the Washington team, now I marched with her 10 years ago, and I still remember one of my favorite memories of cultural misappropriation was Denny Gayton and his son being full-blood Lakota going through the parking lot. We're walking back amongst all these people that are hostile to us, and some people that were inebriated with face paint on looked at him, and they had that, oh, no, a real Indian look on their face. I still remember that 10 years ago. It's priceless.
You refer to it as, oh, no, a look, a real Indian look on their face. What does that face look like? I mean, how do you experience moments like
that? They were embarrassed. You could tell they were embarrassed, and they were caught kind of on the spot. Earlier last year, I saw a guy in the whole face paint thing at a Cleveland Indians game in a picture being confronted by an Indian, and he's trying to talk his way out of it, and you just see that embarrassed backing up look, and I saw that day.
That embarrassed backing up look. I wonder if our guests recognize what you're talking about there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Is this like a universal experience as part of like dealing with race and ethnicity?
I hear it from so many different people. I've experienced it, but I think the one that sticks to me the most is when you have a native-born person here, whether it's Asian or whatever, and they're told to go back to their country. You know, it's like they have no ties to that. They really have integrated and assimilated. They're American. They're whatever these ideals are, whatever this community means. And the shock on their face when somebody tells them to go back to their country, you know, a country that maybe they've been removed from for 3 or 4 generations, is like, I think sometimes that's a deeper wound, because you realize you've become comfortable where you are and you think you've done everything that makes you part of this community, and that somebody can look at you and just by seeing you assume that you don't belong here. And that is tragic.
Yeah, I mean, I think also that, mainstream society tends to have fantasies, and perhaps, you know, other segments of society do as well, have fantasies about how they can interact with or perform in certain ways. I mean, whenever I see people at Chiefs games that wear headdresses or war paint, it's cringeworthy, right? But also, you get a sense that it's sanctioned, too. You have war, quote-unquote, war chants or war whoops happening at the Chiefs games. So, you know, in some ways, it's a fantasy, a collective fantasy about, you know, some organizations, say Florida State University, will say it's a tribute to these groups. But at the same time, the wider conversation is not necessarily pursued or encouraged.
What would your advice be to people who are heading this weekend to the Ethnic Enrichment Festival? I mean, if they want to take what is meant to be an introduction and a celebration and an opportunity to connect and make it something bigger than that, do you have advice?
I would say, you know, I've done this before. Just go up and talk to the people in the booth and then ask them, where do you guys meet? Where is your community? Am I welcome there? You know, some of it may be around the church, community center. It could very well be just a neighborhood. But, you know, I would ask, you know, am I welcome there? I would love to see. Because, I mean, that is really about what you're trying to do, communicate.
I think just to go along with what Jose is saying, too, don't feel bad if you're stuck at 1 or 2 booths, because it's that you meet really interesting people, right? In other words, that there's always going to be another festival, and that people's histories are so complex that you can get lost in a good way in them.
So you're saying maybe quality over quantity.
Absolutely.
Our time is up for today's Central Standard. Anthony Hsu of UMKC's English Department, thanks so much.
Thanks.
And Jose Faust, it's been really great having you.
Thank you, Gina.
Jose, I also hear it's your birthday, so
happy birthday.
Thank you.
This conversation will be online at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Sign up for our podcast while you're there. You'll never miss an episode, and then you'll be really happy. Tomorrow, a renowned bebop scholar visits Kansas City for the first time. He'll stop by Central Standard while he's here, plus two sisters sing the blues. Tune in for that. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. Special thanks to Andrea Tudhope for today's show. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned for Up to Date, coming right up.